Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey, and with me today, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. We have an interloper here today as well.
Who did you bring with you, Nadia? What the hell?
He kind of like snuck under the carriage of my car. He is Anthony. He is my friend.
Hello.
Nadia's friend Anthony. Welcome to the show somehow.
I feel like I can be the sort of the Vincent Valentine or Go-Go for the show this week. It's the optional side character that you can choose to bring along, but a lot of people will be like, "No, I missed that. I'm just going to leave him."
Go-Go is great, but Vincent sucks.
Oh,
all right, Nadia. He can stay. His nerd cred seems reasonably intact.
Yes.
He doesn't eat much.
But this is Anthony Agnello, who's been kicking around the industry for quite a while, and he dropped me a line basically going, "I'm playing RPGs. Can I be on your podcast?" And I said, fine, come on board. We don't have high standards around here, but... So we're going to talk about what Anthony's been playing, which includes Radiant Historia, which is another game that Nadia has also been playing. But first, let's just quickly recap yesterday's Nintendo Direct, or last week's Nintendo Direct, as this podcast is posted. You can tell when we're recording this. So I went into this thinking that there was going to be an update on the new Fire Emblem for the Switch. We were sadly disappointed. That was the piece of news that I wanted the most, I think, along with maybe Xenoblade Chronicles 2 DLC, for example. But
yeah, I'm surprised I wasn't there.
Yeah, I guess Xenoblade Chronicles 2 might be a one-and-done type thing. I'm not sure, but in any case, we did get quite a few announcements. We got South Park coming on to the Switch. You reviewed that, Nadia. What do you think about that?
I reviewed that. It actually would be a perfect game to just kind of play in a handheld mode. It's not a game that, like, I remember it being very divisive, and some people got kind of mad because I wasn't too offended by it. Like, I kind of recognize for how, like, awful it is at the same time. Like, there are certain aspects I really kind of enjoy despite myself. So I would not play it again, I don't think. I think, you know, I've had it once. I'm done with South Park. It was fun. I don't need to pay attention for another 10 years. But if you are a South Park fan and you haven't played it, by all means, you could do a lot worse.
It's not as good as the first game. I was really disappointed that they didn't announce both of them as a bundle for the Switch.
That would have been great.
Because Stick of Truth is a game that I would absolutely replay if they cleaned it up, polished it just a little. But Separate Butthole. The Separate Butthole is not... it's not the best RPG in the world. It's just not...
I know some people... See, I never played the first game, and I've discovered some people find that the battle system for the Fractured Butthole kind of tedious.
It's strange. It's a more mechanically sound battle system. Like, it's more balanced, it's more interesting, but it's just boring. It's just... It's one of those games where it almost feels like all of the parts fit together really, really well, but it's like a Lego set that builds a McDonald's. Instead of a pirate ship or a spaceship,
I'll be honest. I kind of like that. That sounds like kind of a cool idea. Like, hey, there's a McDonald's on your shelf. Why do you have that? I don't know. I felt like building a McDonald's.
I made it. It's my golden.
I made it. What do you think?
Why not?
I think that the main benefit of South Park is that it's going to look really good on the Switch. It's going to look great on that screen. I don't think it's particularly hardware intensive, all things considered.
No, it's really not.
So the Switch should be able to run it without too much problem. Maybe there'll be some load times, I'm not sure. And for people who are like, I like South Park, I mean, that's just an easy sell. It's like, oh yeah, basically you get a South Park cartoon on your Nintendo Switch on the go.
Yeah, one thing about it, I should warn people up front, is that it is definitely longer than Stick of Truth. I think Stick of Truth was about 12 hours. Fractured Butthole took me like 20 hours.
Yeah.
And that was without me farting around too much.
And it just, the end, it's one of those RPGs where it ends, and then it keeps going, it ends again, and then keeps going, and ends a third time.
Yeah, a couple of times I thought, okay, we're done. Oh, no, we're not done. But I will say, I love, who's the name, what's the little diabetes kid? Scott.
He's adorable. Scott Malkinson?
Yes, he's great.
Best character in the entire game.
Oh, he's amazing. I fell in love with that little dude.
Yeah, he's excellent. And now I can't remember what her name is as a superhero, but Wendy.
Call girl.
Call girl with her many different cell phone attacks.
And I just love the phone destroyer clip every time she pulls that off.
Yeah. Just and keep those two in your party through the entire game and you can blast through it.
I had Timmy, too.
And Timmy. Yes.
No, sorry, not Timmy. Jimmy.
Wait, Jimmy's the one who's the Flash.
He's the Flash.
He's the fake Flash, and Timmy is Professor X. Right.
Yes.
I got it. I can remember all these things in that game.
It's because he's in a wheelchair. Get it?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. One thing I would say about this game, I would not recommend playing it on a plane, because...
No.
Yeah, I said on Twitter, when I was live-tweeting the US Gamer Twitter feed during the presentation, and I'm like, hey, South Park is on the Switch now. Show it to your grandma. Don't show it to your grandma. That was a joke.
Absolutely not.
Not one of the ones that you want to just sit there with the audio... If you have a Switch and you get on a plane, you're like, I'm going to do it in that initial Switch announcement video and prop up the screen on my tray. Play it in front of a family of four sitting next to me.
Just kind of tilting it over a little bit on your tray.
Towley having weed rage in his that battle. Lack of weed, rather.
The other game, or the other thing that was announced, we already knew that Dark Souls is coming to the Nintendo Switch, which should be interesting, to be perfectly honest. I find myself a little bit on the fence about whether or not I want to actually get it, because God knows I've played Dark Souls on seemingly everything at this point. Even though the last release was actually just on PC and PS3, but it feels like it's ubiquitous. But in any case, it is coming to the Switch, and it has an amiibo. And
yes.
That's possibly my favorite thing about a game getting ported to the Switch now, is that it feels inevitable that it's going to have an amiibo.
Yeah.
And in this case, it is the perfect amiibo this side of the Gaping Dragon, which is Solaire, the Sunbro, the guy who became a meme unto himself with the Praise the Sun salute, and made an entire generation of people into Sunbros. And yeah, do you guys still collect amiibos?
Here's the thing. When one comes around that I'm really interested in, it's almost always sold out. And by the time I think of getting it again, I just don't care as much. There are certain ones that I adore, like the Woolly Yoshi. I really do kind of want Solaire, but he's probably going to be sold out in 5 seconds. As many listeners of the Blood God know, I have not played Dark Souls, so I think this is my chance.
Oh, Nadia, on a recent episode... I do feel like I'm the guy that's like long-time listener, first-time caller. I know that you were talking about, diving into Dark Souls for the very first time with this release, possibly. And I'm not a Dark Souls neophyte. I've played 2, I've played 3, I've played Bloodborne, I played Demon Souls, but I've never played 1. So I'm going to be joining you in this adventure. And can you explain the Sunbro to me? I don't know this meme. I feel like I'm missing something.
Well, I mean, you see this guy going Praise the Sun really early on and helping you with the battle. And it was just it was a distinctive looking figure. The salute was also pretty distinctive. People would be going, Praise the Sun, etc.
Yeah, and I think Solaire is also, he's kind of a very cheerful character in a very dark and gritty world. And he's very, when you meet him, he's very polite. He has, I can't remember who voices him, but he just has a soft, like really charming voice that everyone fell in love with. And he talks about like jolly cooperation and all this other very British sort of things. He's just kind of a character.
But it's a faction in the game, right? So that you can join, and then you can beam into other people's games to help them out killing monsters. And the great majority of people prefer to do that in Dark Souls versus, say, the hardcore PvP, which is its own faction and that kind of thing. And the faction stuff, I believe, was introduced in Dark Souls, if I recall correctly. So the Solaire came into this game, and Dark Souls, of course, was far more popular than Demon's Souls, ultimately. So, consequently, the Sunbros, and I don't remember their names, so everybody calls them Sunbros, but they've continued through the other Dark Souls games, and just everybody has kind of their preferred niche, and that is one of them. And Solaire, I think, exemplifies probably the most popular faction in the game.
Yeah, I didn't know Solaire was only in Dark Souls 1. I thought maybe he had a presence in the other games, too, other than Bloodborne.
So I have... he might be in the sequels, but I have this sort of blind spot when it comes to the Souls games. I get about 15 hours in, and up to that point, I'm like, I'm getting it, I'm enjoying myself. And then about at that, like, Baker's dozen hours... I'll run into that boss or that section that just keeps pummeling me, and I say, "No, man, life's too short. I'm out.
I got
what I need. I'll go play with a real cane sword instead of this for a while." So,
I'm the kind of person who I run into a hard boss and I go, I'll fight it a couple times just to kind of get a feel for how it actually goes or how the fight actually goes. Mm. And then once I feel like I have a pretty decent feel for it, I will make sure that I'm at my most powerful, like I'm in human mode and all that. And I will actually call in people to help me out, because I have no shame whatsoever about calling people into my game to give me a hand with a boss.
And yeah, I should really do that more.
And almost inevitably, the people who are still playing Dark Souls right now, it can be hard to matchmake, especially with some of the older games, but the people who are still playing Dark Souls know that game so well that they will come in and practically solo the boss for you. I remember Bob telling me that when he beat Dark Souls the first time, he got to the final boss and... like, he called somebody in to help, and that person just walked in and proceeded to kick the living crap out of the final boss. And he was like, okay, great. Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
So if you want to see the end of the game, there you go. That's how you do it.
Are you, even though, so you like the difficulty of the game, but do you like not beating the boss?
Here's the secret. I don't like the difficulty of the game. I don't care about the difficulty of the game. What I care about is the really cool gothic atmosphere.
Yeah.
I care about the kick-ass boss battles. I care about the mechanical depth. I think the online community is really awesome. And it's a great world to explore, right? There are so many interesting mysteries and secrets and things to find throughout. And I don't want to get stuck. And so I have no qualms whatsoever calling in somebody and enjoying a really epic boss battle.
That atmosphere is so goddamn good that I long for an easy mode. I long for an easy mode. I keep waiting for the moment that they say that the Switch version will have Funky Kong mode or the equivalent of Funky Kong mode. You know, not that your grimdark, you know, knight will have a surfboard that they hop around the world in, but that it is the, like, we understand that you're playing this with Joy-Cons, probably. They're teeny tiny controllers. Let's make this easy on you.
The thing is, there is an easy mode. The easy mode is go on the internet and look up the strongest and most overpowered build. And put that onto your character, and you will probably wreck shop. Yeah, I mean, I was doing that in Dark Souls 3 without too much trouble. I can't remember the exact sword I picked, but I picked one of the most overpowered swords, gave it to my character, and was actually having little to no trouble getting through the game, and I was totally fine with that. The thing is, though, with Dark Souls is that it also caters to a distinct hardcore who can do shit like beat the game with DK bongo drums, and it's a great way to show off on Twitch. But if you are a casual fan, there is in fact a way to get through the game without actually too much trouble. Like, people have been playing this long enough that they have figured out how to break the hell out of that game.
Yeah, they would have, yeah.
Yeah.
Did someone seriously do... That's right, someone did do DK Bongos, didn't they?
Yeah, they beat it with a variety of weird-ass controllers, and I'm just like, what the hell, man?
I just remember Twitch playing it, and when they went up against Ornstein and Smog, that was a real adventure.
I reviewed that game, and Ornstein and Smog almost killed me. And like literally,
real life,
like I almost died because I was just, it was like 2 a.m. and I have to finish this game. Like time is running low on up until embargo. And I'm just like, I'm never going to finish this game. It's literally impossible. I can't do it. I cannot beat these guys. These guys are too hard. What have
In
I done?
Head, they're a married couple.
They are totally a married.
They're
see,
totally a married couple.
See, Nadia's already going for the frickin' fan fiction. My God.
just shipping that Dark Souls before it's even played.
Shipping that Cannibal and that Dragon Slayer.
Anyway, the amiibo, there was some confusion about the salute, whether or not you would be able to do the Praise the Sun salute only with the amiibo, but it's not locked behind it. In fact, it just makes it so that you can have it immediately, so you don't have to join the Sun Bros. You can have it right then.
Oh, you don't have to be part of their little club.
That's yeah, you can. You scan bro. In the amiibo, you can do the emote. It's possibly the lamest bit of exclusive amiibo physical DLC ever, but
well,
whatever.
Worse
right?
than the Metroid 2 remake that came out last year. That was pretty bad. That was like the fusion.
The hard mode, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was actual content.
Yeah, it's true, Shay. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, that Metroid amiibo is really freaking cool.
Oh, it's
that
so
was.
Good.
Here's the thing about amiibo versus like Skylanders, which are all rotting at the bottom of some poison landfill somewhere. People basically collect amiibo because they are fun. Like, I don't care if you can do anything with Solaire. He's just a cheap, fun figure that I can put on my desk and laugh at.
Yep.
That's all I require. I don't really require much in the way of in-game content.
I collect amiibo because Nintendo won't stop sending them to me.
Well, still not as good as the cup noodles.
That's a good reason. Here's my life hack for amiibo, and I'm saying life hack. I don't want you to think that I'm a person who uses that phrase earnestly, but this is my solution to making amiibo practical. If you like having a Christmas or holiday tree, they're the best ornaments of all time.
Yes,
they're the best ornaments.
I have
of
seen
all
people
time.
Do that conversion process.
Yeah,
it's really fun.
Super simple.
I have only purchased one amiibo on my own with my own hard-earned cash, and that was the Duck Hunt amiibo, because loved the dog with the bird. I just happened to see it at some store, and I was like, oh my God, that's an amazing amiibo. I want that, and I bought it, and I was happy.
They're really cute.
Yes.
That's a duck.
Honestly, a lot of the other amiibos are actually kind of underwhelming in terms of the actual design. There's some really good ones, but a lot of the ones are just kind of like, it's okay. But
yeah, like I said, I love the Wooly Yoshi. I like the unique one.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah, there's some really good ones. But God, my house has enough toys in it as it is, so it's like...
Yeah.
I'm like, no more amiibos. Okay, last thing before we move on. Nadia, last week we were talking about what we were hoping we would get out of the Valkyrie profile... Leneth teaser, and we officially have an announcement, and it's a mobile game.
I'm so
sorry.
It's a
friggin' mobile game, man. And not just a mobile game, it's a mobile game port of the friggin' PSP remake.
Jeez, that's just painful. And I mean, it's not the first time Square has ported their handheld games to mobile. Like, they did that for Final Fantasy IV DS, and they did that for After Years, too, for some reason. And, Square just loves that kind of low effort, low budget project to bring in some quick cash. I'm sorry, though.
But the PSP version, I feel like, Kat, are you and I two of the five people in existence that played the PSP version?
I didn't play the PSP version. I had the PlayStation version, and I didn't feel any particular need to buy the PSP version when I read that it was kind of the inferior version. People were saying that it was kind of fuzzy. Didn't have the amenities of the English release and things like that. So I was like, why would I buy this thing?
The load times are... And this is a game that I have
load times.
I've attempted to play Valkyrie Profile like 6 times over the past 20 years, and I never make it more than a few hours in. I've tried it on both the PS1 and the PSP. I never make it that far. The PSP version is unplayable because of the load times.
Right.
It is unplayable. playable. And given Square's track record with optimizing these re-releases, I don't have a ton of faith. And, like, not just the UMD version. If you play a legitimately acquired digital version of the PSP version of Valkyrie Profile, that's not a thing you can get. But if you do just play the ISO, it's no better. No better.
I ripped the disc, the PSX disc, to my PC and playing in an emulator. And that is probably the best way to play Valkyrie Profile at this point. If you have a PC that, I mean, you should have a PC that can handle it, but...
Yeah, this point, you should have had one by 98.
Yeah. I wouldn't go that far, but I think the thing with Valkyrie Profile, and it pains me to say this, but I think that the really long story cutscenes can be pretty ponderous for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it takes a long time to get through. I like watching the stories because I find some of them are boring, some of them go way too long, but there are others that are like genuinely sad, or genuine, a lot of, like, I mean, you're watching, in every one of them, you're watching somebody die, and you're watching their last moments, and so it could be like, it can be pretty intense, actually, and, but, yeah, in any case, like, in terms of actual modern RPGs, I think a lot of people would find Valkyrie Profile to be relatively slow going, which is kind of why I was hoping for like a remastered version that
just
lets you go
just
fast forward through them. I don't know. Yeah, it's not happening. Valkyrie Profile is not enough of a property.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering if I should just kind of just bite the bullet, get the PS1 version and play it for
like $100.
More than that at this point. It's like
not as bad as Suikoden 2 in the heyday, but still not great.
Yeah, it's not exactly Panzer Dragoon, but geez.
Are you a Valkyrie Profile 2 Silmaria fan?
Not really. No.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a cheaper option, but it's also not great.
Well, Silmaria, I was ranting about this in the previous episode. It stripped away a lot of the character and the fun of the original Valkyrie Profile, and I didn't like the main character particularly. Like, I guess she had a decent arc, but she was pretty boring. At the start. The one thing that I would say that was really good about Silmaria is that they took the battle system that they introduced in the original Valkyrie Profile and really beefed it up in some pretty interesting ways by having you running around on a 3D battlefield, breaking off parts of bosses, things like that, too. So, like, they did some cool stuff with the actual battle system. And at the end of the day, I didn't regret my time with Silmaria. But as far as follow-ups to the original Valkyrie Profile, I was like, eh. Also, it came out in, like, 2006 when the PS1 was based. PS2 was dead or getting there. So, unfortunate.
Wait, that was when Odin Sphere was coming out.
It's true.
Such a good game. I actually played that for the first time.
Okami came out in 2006 as well.
That's true as well. It's coming to Switch 2. Woo!
Yeah, another game.
Fast forward.
Man, they managed to get a lot of juice out of that game, I gotta tell you.
They really did. Hey, you didn't play it the first time? Well, guess what, assholes?
Yeah, that game bored the heck out of me when it came out. I'm not gonna lie.
Talk about ponderous.
I have tried to play the remaster, and I really appreciate it for what it is, but I find the text is so slow, and you really can't go through it as quickly as I'd really like to, and I hope they fix that on the Switch, but they won't.
No, they won't. Capcom doesn't put work into its Switch ports? Come on!
Remember the time when I came out on the Wii and people discovered the IGN watermark?
That was classic. That was like one of my top 10 industry moments.
That's from the period of time where Capcom was... there was a stretch where Capcom was making the best retail packages of all time. The Okami Wii release and Resident Evil Revelations. Not Revelation.
They misspelled their name at one point, too, I remember, on one of the boxes. I can't remember what game it was for, but they were like Capcom or something.
Yes! That's,
hey, Capcom's stepping up its game right now. I mean, Street Fighter 30th Anniversary is coming out from the Digital Eclipse people. Mega Man Anniversary Collection was outstanding.
Yeah.
They are fine. I think they got a fire lit under their ass because they were looking pretty grim there for a while.
And I'll be honest, Monster Hunter World's my game of the year right now. And
Monster Hunter World is pretty fantastic, frankly.
I freaking love that game. Have you been playing Monster Hunter World?
I've been so ensconced in playing Xenoblade 2 over the past couple of months.
That's That's such a good game.
It is so good. And I don't understand why... The only explanation I have for people being mixed on it is that it is the level of time investment you need to get to realizing that it is not just a good game, but a great game is huge.
It is very time intensive.
So
Titty Bunny.
Yeah, there's also... All right, why does every rare blade have to wear a thong? Because it's not just...
God decreed it.
It's gender and species neutral. One of the main characters that's a blade is a tiger, and he is wearing a tiger thong. And I don't understand what's happening.
I do have to say, you're right, the male blades, some of them are very revealing. They didn't get much press. I got one guy who has he's kind of revealing, and he was designed actually by the woman who did the Figaro twins from Final Fantasy VI.
Oh.
And he's got a tap on his waist, like a water tap, because he's a water blade. It's amazing.
Yes.
This game's amazing. I don't care.
Yeah. So all of which is to say that Monster Hunter World is such a time sink too, that I went in, I created a character who's just Geralt from Witcher. It's just Geralt down to the face scar and everything, and then I got out and said, that'll be there for me when I'm done with Xenoblade 2, but now Yakuza 6 is so close that I think Monster Hunter World's getting pushed further and further back. That's a game that I really wish was on the Switch too. That's a lying in bed game to me.
But my PS4 struggles to run it, so I don't know how it would do on the Switch.
Yeah.
I'm on the final boss, or I'm near the final boss, because the way it goes is you go through, like, there are three elder dragons that you have to take out, mm-hmm. and they're kind of like the Elite Four, I guess, in Pokemon.
They're all dragon trainers.
Yeah, and then you go to this place called the Everstream or something. I'm about to head there, and I guess perhaps I'm going to fight a final boss there, perhaps, and maybe that's when the credits will roll. So
I'm going to kick the circle of life in the nuts.
I've put 70 hours into this game somehow. I don't even know how I did that.
That's not too bad.
Yeah.
For an art like Xenoblade Chronicles 2, I put 200 hours into that game. Easy. And that's not even everything done.
Nadia, I'm at chapter 9, and my clock is at 60 hours. I feel like I'm going really fast.
How did you do that?
All right, so I will say that if you haven't played it since they patched it about a week ago, I went to easy mode immediately. I went to easy mode, and all of a sudden... The thing about easy mode that's amazing is that it doesn't make the game less challenging. You can still die really fast in fights, but there is no longer the chipping away of health and enemies. It just halves battle time. So I think the last, like, chapter 7 and 8, which are very dungeon-centric...
Yeah, I hated that dungeon.
Yeah, you blast through there, as opposed to just spending hours and hours and hours. So I think a 7-hour dungeon took me 2.5, which is...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That'll do it. That's great.
That'll do it. Kat, you forgot something from the Nintendo Direct. Project Octopath has a release date, finally. And a dude with a lute. And a dancing lady.
A dude with a lute. I hate bards.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know about this game. I think it's so...
I do.
It's so pretty.
Did you play the demo?
It's... Okay. So, I loved the demo, but did you do the you know how the director was there saying, well, we've listened to everybody's feedback.
Yeah.
And we've changed the game in real time. I watched the YouTube video they put out about a month ago saying, these are the things we changed. We made it so that you can skip cutscenes if you've died. You can, you know, save anywhere and all these things. But I want them to cut that script back, because every character has, like, 5 more lines than they need. Just, if you're going to imitate those old 16-bit RPGs, you got to keep it snappy. As opposed
to
just...
Well, I wonder who did the script this time around. I guess it's not Alexander O. Smith, but kind of has almost his
that
sense
flavor.
On it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that flavor, definitely. Which is great. I mean, I love his work. But.
Yeah. It definitely already feels bravely default, bravely second-ish in terms of the story.
That's not a bad thing, as long as they don't make it as grindy as Bravely Default.
And that's one of the things they said. They said, we recognize that people want to be able to get through battles quicker, and I was like, yes! Awesome.
Yeah.
Tokyo RPG Factory, take notes. You're next.
No kidding. Tokyo RPG Factory.
I feel bad for them. Yeah, their follow-up effort got almost no coverage from anybody because it was just the second that it came out, that was like, yeah, it's slightly better than the previous effort, but not by much. I was like, oh, like there was a definite
It didn't really grab me, and this is when I think this is when Monster Hunter just came out and everything, and I was like, I'm going to play Monster Hunter. I'm sorry. I understand what you're doing, and I appreciate it, but it's just... I am just not that interested.
But on the subject of Project Octopath Traveler, I guess I'm reasonably excited for it. It's going to be a good Switch game. Great handheld Switch game coming out summer, if I recall correctly. So
yeah, it was before my birthday, July 13th, I think.
This feels like it was kind of made for Nadia. This is a Nadia game.
Watch me hate it, and I'll hate myself.
I don't know. You're not the type to hate things very much.
No, I don't hate things very often. I'm like Mike in that regard.
You're a lover, not a hater.
That's very true. I am very much a lover, not a hater. I don't get angry very often.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see. Like, and I know that we were like pretty pumped up about Octopath Traveler last year when the demo came out. Like, in hindsight, I'm like, we'll see.
Yeah.
But in any case, I wanted to get back to something we were talking about earlier. Like, Anthony, why do you consider... Well, what made Xenoblade Chronicles 2 a great game as opposed to just a good game for you?
It sounds so dumb and simple when I think of it. It's just the perfect confluence of art, story, mechanics, and just world vision. Everything that makes a good RPG a great RPG is in Xenoblade 2 and working in concert. And I can't... This is really annoying. I can never remember the director's name. The Xeno guy.
His name always was
Mr. Xeno!
Mr. Xeno guy.
But Xenoblade 2 is the first time that I think one of his games has truly cohered into a whole, instead of being a collection of really, really good ideas that don't quite work. Even, like, I love Xenogears as much as the next person who came of age during the PlayStation era. You know, it's a fascinating, fascinating, beautiful game, but it's a frustrating mess. And Xenosaga, all of the Xenosaga games are frustrating messes. That's a situation where the art is beautiful and the story is super interesting, but the story is terribly told. And the story is terribly told inconsistently, where they keep trying to do different things over these three games. Doesn't work there. Xenoblade 1 is a beautiful world, but you can't turn off battle voices in Xenoblade 1. unless you're ready for 100 hours of, what a bunch of jokers! What a bunch of jokers!
Do you use the English voices in 2?
Yes, I love the English voices in 2.
I love them, they're so great.
I turned
so
it to crazy. Japanese, and I preferred it in Japanese.
Did you stick with it past the beginning? Because I feel like the beginning of Xenoblade 2, the English voices were... They just didn't do more than one take. They were just like... They just recorded the like script read and were like, that's fine, moving on.
Yeah, but there actually are some moments that are dramatic that Rex actually delivers surprisingly well. And Torna is mostly voiced really well. Who's that rip-off Cecil character?
rip-off Cecil character.
Zeke?
No, not Zeke.
Not Zeke.
The guy who looks like Cecil from Dissidia.
Cecil from Dissidia. I thought you meant isn't Cecil the bard in 4? Final Fantasy 4?
No, God, no. We're not friends anymore. Cecil is the paladin. He's the main character from Final Fantasy 4.
Oh my God. Now my cred is gone. All my cred is out the window.
But I really like Torna because towards the end of the game, mild spoilers, you kind of begin to realize that they're maybe even lovers, but that's the main character, the main villain, and
everybody is lovers with everybody in Xenoblade 2. That's the other thing I realized.
They're just a good villain troupe.
I feel like, can we talk about spoilers for Xenoblade? I feel like it's a long enough game, and it came out only 3 months ago. I don't want to give too many things away.
Should we say spoilers from here on out? For Xenoblade Chronicles 2, check the podcast notes to see when we pick up the next topic. Go.
So one of the things that makes this game truly great is, to your point, Nadia, like, it does seem like everybody is in an intimate relationship in this game. Every single character is either,
everybody's
like,
screwing their blade, just putting it out there.
Yeah, everybody is boning their sword to hell and back. But there's also a profound and explicit intimacy between the characters of friendship. There's a very dramatic moment about two-thirds of the way through the game. It's sort of the climax of the second act, where one of the main characters, Nia, it's revealed that Nia herself is a blade, that she is not 100% human. And as she, you know, accepts her identity for the first time, she yells to the main character, "I love you." She just says flat out, "I love you." And it's not like, "And we should get married and buy an island together and then get a dog." It's not
get a dog. Yes.
It's not that kind of love. It is, she is saying, like, "You are my most precious friend in the world. And because of this journey we've been on together, I am comfortable being who I really am."
And yeah, that, like, it's
exceptional. It's an exceptional, exceptional character moment. And that's, you know, that's why people like JRPGs, right? That sort
And also Brigid and
Morag.
Morag. They are totally together.
Like, absolutely.
They are 100% together. Like, Morag says outright, "I would not want to live without Brigid." And I think Brigid says the same thing. And it's just, they're not like all grand and grandiose about it. They're very just down to earth. Like, she is my everything. Like, she is everything in my life.
Yeah.
It's so sweet.
Yeah.
Man, I wasn't even paying attention to half of what was going on in Xenoblade Chronicles 2 stories. I'm like, who are these characters? What? I put like 40 hours into this game. I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Who's Morag?
Morag is the chick with the cool engineer's hat.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Morag's the Valkyria Chronicles, that some character that somehow escaped Valkyria Chronicles and ended up in Xenoblade.
I remember the little fuzzy thing. I remember a kid with diving hat. I remember girl who's a blade, actually, but is kind of all, I don't know. Like,
do you remember Joramark? Joramark's the one who counts the most.
He's the tiger.
I liked the battle system. I liked the graphics, and so that's kind of what kept me going throughout. And I liked the blade gacha system. And I kind of sat around going, "Oh, I can't believe they didn't make this into a microtransaction type thing." EA. I'm glad EA didn't get their hands on this game. But
yeah, we were talking about how if there was an executive from EA looking over the developer's shoulders, they'd be like, "Why isn't this monetized?
Oh God,
well, why isn't this monetized?
Why aren't these coming out of card packs?" Is what it comes down to. Yeah.
Build your Xenoblade Ultimate team in the most social Electronic Arts role playing experience.
God damn it.
I'm
getting a little bit of PTSD right here, Anthony. Don't do that.
It was too real. It was too real.
It's a little bit too real.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to another E3. Today, we're going to talk about an exciting, socially engaged racing soccer role-playing experience set in the Madden franchise.
Wait, tell me more about this. This sounds like my game of the year right here.
Yeah, you've got cast
attention. Yeah, that's
you have my
really
attention.
Yeah,
Madden's creative director is one of the biggest JRPG fans you'll ever meet.
I would never have been able to tell that from this past year's Madden.
He tweets at me periodically about random RPGs. It's pretty funny, actually. But, it just goes to show that sports and RPGs, not that far away from each other. But getting back to Xenoblade Chronicles 2, I guess the characters' designs and the characters themselves didn't appeal to me a huge degree, but it's kind of what you're looking for. What are you looking for in an RPG, right? You guys are clearly looking for an engaging story, and you're talking about how these characters are pairing up and everything. And I'm just kind of looking toward the battle system going, this is a nice repetitive motions, the kind of game. I was playing it while watching Parks and Rec with the sound turned off, basically. And it's like, but the music's great. And I'm just like, I know the music's great, but this is a game I'm playing while watching Parks and Rec.
See, I did the exact same thing with the first, I'd say, like 25 hours of Xenoblade. And again, I think part of the reason I'm blasting through this is that I am just ignoring all of the side quests. because
oh,
they're
I did like Gollum.
They're the worst sort of just like go to this thing, then come back once you have the thing. Like it's just the there's no very few of them I will say have
yeah,
rich character.
There are a couple that have like a better narrative, but yeah. even those kind of end suddenly. Like I was following a narrative with the rebellion that was mm-hmm. trying to like assassinate a political figure, and. It could have been delivered better. Like,
and it ends with them saying, "Thank you for bringing us 20 logs." See ya.
Yeah.
Thank you for the logs.
We're gonna build a big fire.
But those first 25 hours, I just played watching old X-Files. Like, I just and
nice.
it was a TV RPG companion, which you know I like that mechanical, like you said, repetitive battle system. I like grinding and dragging quest to a nice TV show.
Well, but, I listen to music for that.
Yeah, it gets to... Xenoblade gets to a point where all of those different things start to click in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a long time to get there.
It really does. Like, I didn't really... Like, what we're talking about, Anthony and I, I didn't even start to notice that until far past 40 hours into the game,
yeah.
So don't worry, Kat.
Yeah.
I can't imagine putting 200 hours into that game. I can't.
I just really enjoyed it. Like, I won't say it's a perfect RPG, but I just for what the sum of its parts, I think it's a lot of fun. Also, I like how Dromark, he gets so offended if, like, Nia suggests that his fur is not perfectly soft and luxurious. he is very sad about that.
He is like, if Alfred from Batman were a giant cat...
Yes.
It would be Dromark, which is not something I realized I wanted in a role-playing game until it was presented to me.
Exactly. No, it's a pretty great combination.
Are you guys both people who enjoy the RPG that lasts, like, 200 hours? Because I usually... Mm-hmm. I have, like, a 100-hour barrier where I don't really ever want to go past that.
It really depends. Like, I think Xenoblade might be an exception.
Mm.
Maybe the other exception I can think of is Skyrim.
It has to be a friggin' incredible RPG for me to want to put more than 100 hours into it. I mean, to even get to the 100-hour mark, it has to be a friggin' incredible RPG for me. Like,
yeah.
Because my time is so limited these days, I have to want to come back repeatedly. And I think at this point, we're talking Pantheon-level games here that will get me to put in more than 100 hours, like Witcher 3, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that I've put 70 hours into Monster Hunter World, I think maybe tells you how good this game is. The fact that it's got me motivated to grind and try to get the best gear. Otherwise, it's like, once I hit like the 50, 60-hour mark, I'm like, okay, I'm fine. Yeah, I've gotten everything I wanted in this game. We were talking about side quests. Witcher 3... I mean, that should be just a great example of a game of what can happen when you don't neglect the side quests, when you put a lot of effort into the side quests to make them really great and really engaging, because they're such a great way to tell a story within a story, to have a nice little arc. And when you just make it into busy work, that is, it actually lowers the quality of the game.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, nobody wants to collect 5 logs. Yeah, I get it. I get it that there are people who are like super OCD about that shit, but it's not fun. It's a job.
Tedious.
It's a thing that they feel compelled to complete. It's like achievement hunters. They're not necessarily having fun doing that. They're doing it because they must have every achievement ever. So I just, Dragon Age did this too. You know, it's like, I would rather have way fewer side quests.
Mm-hmm.
If they're good, if they kick serious ass. I mean, one of the things that annoyed me about Horizon Zero Dawn, even, was they were talking, it's like, well, we had this system, and we were just basically going, side quest, side quest, side quest, side quest, side quest, and we're just dumping them into the game. And I'm like, my God, that's so simple and so mechanical. Put a little craft into this. Don't just, mm-hmm. just don't crank them out. Come on.
Yeah. The moment I saw a notification pop up, in Horizon Zero Dawn. And this is actually embarrassing, because I was on the air doing a stream with the mission designer, and a little pop-up comes up that's just... It was like, you've knocked out this number of the bandit camps. And I immediately said, like, that's it. I'm done playing this game. I'm never... As soon as we're done with this interview, I'm out. Because... That sort of side quest tedium, it chases me away from a story. Like, I find it galling to the point that it makes me not want to play the rest of the game. It's what sort of ruined the Assassin's Creed series to me, because the balance of get all those feathers to actual interesting story became out of whack. I feel like there's an expectation for modern game makers, not just RPG designers, to add as much value as possible.
Yeah,
it has to be
absolutely
all the value in the world. It has this many side quests when, you know, I think at the end of the day, if you just follow Chrono Trigger's model, Chrono Trigger has maybe 10 side quests total?
Yeah, towards the end of the game, you can, like, most of them are optional. It depends how you, if you finish them, it can affect your ending.
Right. But, and all of them are interesting. Like, every single one is interesting. And The Witcher does that, but you can't count The Witcher. The Witcher is like the Beatles of RPGs now. Like, it's too... You gotta remove it from the conversation, because I don't know what demon CD Projekt Red made a deal with to make all of those side quests that narratively rich, but not even Persona 5 pulled that off. Comes damn close, but...
It's the best and most important game of this generation, bar none.
Definitively. There's just... nothing is going to top that until technology becomes something else. Right.
Well, we'll see with Cyberpunk, but I mean,
that's not a game.
It's a card game.
We're totally going to see it at E3. I'm telling you. All right. Before we wrap up, I promised people that we would have a Radiant Historia discussion, but we kind of went down a pretty deep rabbit hole, which is not a bad thing to be in a podcast, I don't think. I think those are the best kinds of conversations. But Anthony, you've been playing Radiant Historia. Nadia, you've been playing Radiant Historia. Discuss.
Dueling Historias. Now, see, I haven't gotten too far because I have done the prologue. I'm in chapter one, and I'm getting destroyed. This isn't a very easy game. I'm like, okay, I'll grind for some gold and some experience, and I realize, oh, you have to pull off combos to get a decent amount of gold. But I am definitely intrigued by the concept, and I am surging ahead. Anthony, do you like the game?
So, this is my second time playing Radiant Historia. Kat, I actually played the original Radiant Historia based
what?
On your recommendation.
Hey.
What was this, like 2011?
This is back in 2011 on the old 1UP podcast.
Oh, after Time Babble?
Well, no, it would have been Role Players Realm, right?
Yeah, Role Players Realm. And I was like on the treadmill just being like, oh my god. Not another Atlas RPG. That is as tiring as this workout. I got. But you said the magic words. You said it really feels like they're putting in the effort on this one.
Yes.
And, you know, like all the way down to the music. Like Yoko Shimomura is busting out all the stops for this one. Mm-hmm. So I played through that entire game, which I know a lot of people didn't, and as you're discovering, Nadia, it's a very laborious RPG.
Absolutely.
So this is my second time through, and I wanted to play it again just because I, despite the fact that it's flawed and laborious, I loved it. Music, art, so, so good. So I'm playing this on the new easy mode.
That's a thing.
Which is a thing. You can play this game while skipping almost all of the combat while still getting all of the experience. It doesn't do the thing like Bravely Default where it says, of course you can skip combat and you'll never beat the game.
yes.
Yeah, you can just walk up to enemies, slash them with a sword, and you get all the experience and money for that, and you only have to fight bosses or event fights. And so far it's really good. I do not care for the new character art. I don't know why they changed that. It's the weirdest remake choice
this is my first time with the game, and most of the character art I'm fine with. I'm fine with the way Stock looks. What the hell is up with Raoul?
I can't.
This looks like He-Man on steroids.
Yes.
Like, really flowing hair. It's gorgeous hair. But he's got a weird face.
I think it's... the new art makes more sense than the old art, because in the new one, it just looks like he's, like, riding a big, ridiculous suit of armor, and he has a normal-sized head. In the original game, he does just look like... He looks like he is a knight who ate the gum from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory that made Violet Beauregard into a giant blueberry. I don't know. But yeah, so you like the way the characters look in this, Nadia? You're into it?
I'm okay with it. I don't hate it or love it. The one thing that has me conflicted, though, you're talking about the easy mode, and it's like, yeah, the battles are very laborious. They don't give out much in the way of experience or gold, but I do kind of like that grid system where you push the enemies around, run them into each other.
Yeah.
I find that very interesting, but I feel like I'd get tired of it. But you can't really switch between easy and normal.
Yeah.
I think once you stick to easy, you have to stick with easy.
Yeah, the game says right at the beginning, you're stuck in this mode, which I don't understand why a game wouldn't give you that option. You know, Xenoblade 2 lets you switch back and forth between the modes. Now, Persona 5, I don't think Persona 5 would be, you know, worth completing if it didn't let you go between difficulty settings.
Yeah.
I will say, and I'd be interested to know how you feel about it once you're at the end of the game, because that grid system in Radiant Historia is a fascinating battle system. And there's nothing, if anybody listening hasn't played this before, you have a grid of 9 boxes, and enemies will be placed sort of anywhere on it. Almost looks like a tic-tac-toe board. And what you want to do is you want to knock as many of those enemies onto a single square as possible. So your main character, Stock, has, you know, his first special move is push back. Yes. And then he learns push left. And so it's, you know, constant using all of your characters in a... It almost is like a Final Fantasy X style turn system where you can see where everybody's going to be. And then part of the strategy is jockeying where they're going to be in the turn order. And then making sure that all those enemies are in one spot. And it's super, super satisfying. And as you get more characters, it keeps changing. Like, different characters have different ways to push people about that grid.
Yeah.
The problem is the game is long. It's like 60 hours long, and that battle system stops evolving at around 20. So you the battles stay challenging and long, but it stays stagnant. Like, it doesn't change that much. You don't learn a lot of new abilities to keep it spicy. So that's, you know, the easy mode is if you're coming back to this game for all the new story stuff that they added in, it's kind of the only option.
Yeah, they do have the enemies on field, and you can actually get the jump on them if you're quick, but they will chase after you, so you're not always guaranteed to get away if you don't want to engage in battle. So that's kind of a pain in the butt.
Nadia, I don't know anything about Dragon Quest XI yet, but I'm wondering, is there any RPG out there that actually has random battles anymore? Because I feel like everybody's moved on.
I think even like the remakes of the old Dragon Quest have gotten rid of random battles.
Yeah.
Like 3DS games.
So 7 and 8 have them on the field.
And it's for the best, because random battles...
Yeah, I think so.
Random battles are bad.
They're not good.
There's no reason to have them, frankly.
No, Pokemon has them still, and we'll have them forever. Because, and I asked them, I was like, will you ever get rid of random battles? And they're like, no, because we like, because they said we like the surprise of...
Pokemon does have that element of surprise going on, though. Like, you never know what you're going to run into. That's the whole point of Pokemon, practically.
Yeah, exactly. The idea is, I mean, all of Pokemon is basically a random number generator of what you're going to run into in the grass. And it has mechanics that allow you to skip over battles entirely, where it's like you can take max... I always have like 20 max repels with me just to... so I can avoid the random battles and everything. But it's part and parcel. I think they see it as part and parcel of the appeal of Pokemon, that you don't see the monsters until they pop out of the grass, that you are... being surprised by the way they pop out.
Yeah,
so.
But as you say, even the newer games, if you don't want to get into random battles, like, you have a chance to just kind of cancel it a lot of the time, and they still have like specialized battles that you kind of, where you do see the enemy on screen, and you can choose to engage them or not.
And it's essential in some caves where there's a high encounter rate with friggin' Zubats.
Of course.
That will send their friggin' supersonic at you and confuse you, and then you hurt yourself in your confusion, and then they poison you, and then you're what the fuck?
And then you're too lazy to switch out, and you're like, no, I'm going to get this, and you keep punching yourself in the face for every turn, and it just...
And then they use supersonic again! You can't escape! Oh, and then they use mean look, and you can't run away.
Oh, do they know mean look? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, Golbat totally knows mean look.
Oh, stupid Golbat.
Yeah, they're the worst. And they're faster than you. They're always faster than
you. They always go first, and their first move is always supersonic. Yeah, that's why you take the matchup.
If you want a reason to carry a Pikachu with you into battle, so that it will outspeed and kill those freaking Zubats.
Yeah. Okay, Pikachu, this is your time to shine.
And yeah. the relative of the Zubat in the water is the Tentacool, who will pop out every like a couple steps and harass you there too. And then they will be busy poisoning you. Ah, that's the worst.
Do they paralyze you too? I think they can.
I don't remember that. There is one monster, I think it's Muk, who will use Minimize over and over again to raise its evasion so you can't hit it.
Oh, yes.
There are electrodes that will blow up. Like,
why do we put up with Pokemon?
I was just going to say, I have played 4 Pokemon games. I played Pearl, I played a little bit of X and Y, I played Black and White 2.
And best one.
I played Blue. I have no clue about half of the stuff you guys just said. Like that, like there is, you can play Pokemon. I have never beaten a Pokemon game. I've never seen the credits roll. But even after like pouring like 40 hours into these, I can't speak Pokemon player. Like you have to learn it. Like it's a language.
Especially if you're a competitive player, absolutely. Kat knows the competitive language a little bit more than I do.
Yeah, though I've been left behind, sadly. GameSpot has their own Pokemon expert who actually freaking plays in competitive like tournaments and stuff, and I'm like, I must destroy you. How dare you? Well, she plays doubles. Yeah, the problem is that the Pokemon metagame left me behind because they went with doubles instead of singles, and that always really burned me up. I get it. Yeah, doubles has more tactical possibilities. It's perhaps more interesting to watch on the screen, but I just could never be bothered to learn that metagame. I like the singles metagame. It's the one that I know. So, as a consequence, and plus, I mean, at a certain point, I just didn't have time to grind up new monsters. Like, I'd be like, I am going to build a team for this version. How much time do I need to put into building this team? Oh, it's going to take a good 30 hours.
Yeah, forget it.
Oh,
it doesn't actually take that long. If you really lock in and focus, you can raise a Pokemon in about 2 hours. But that involves a lot of repetitive riding back and forth, getting the right egg, making sure that you have the right Dittos to do the thing, and then you got to get the moves, and then you have to raise it up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until finally you have the monster that you want, only to discover that it's completely outdated because the friggin' metagame has shifted while you were doing this. And you're like, cool, this monster's useless. Great.
You gotta, like, follow Smogon with a magnifying glass.
Yeah. So I don't have time for that anymore, but
I play Pokemon Go. That's really simple.
That's one of the reasons that I've been beating the drum so hard for literally any solo PvE content for high-level players who just do not care about competitive Pokemon anymore. And I'm very firmly in that camp. I do not care. I do not want to play competitive Pokemon much anymore. It's a pain in the ass, and I think the metagame hasn't been fun since, frankly, Black and White. Like, it got a lot worse in X and Y, and it got even worse still in Sun and Moon. I'm sick of it. I miss the way it was like 3 generations ago, but I digress. In any case, I am waiting for them to put in the Battle Frontier. I'm waiting for them. I was talking to Robert Boyd on Twitter and talking about how we really, really need a hard mode or some kind of randomized dungeon that high level players can explore with their monsters. Like anything to keep me playing after I beat the Elite Four.
Like Pokemon Mystery Dungeon.
Because the Battle Tower exists just to grind. It's just there to grind for items so you can play competitively. And I get that the bread and butter of Pokemon is sharing and playing with other people. I get that, but okay.
Yeah, you need what the new Radiant Historia has, which is a Uber dungeon at the end that's just ass-kicking battles to let you engage with that weird battle system.
Or like DQ11. Or like Dragon Quest XI, where you get the maps that send you into deep, dark, high-level dungeons or something like that.
Oh, was that 9? Or yeah, that was 9, right?
That was 9, yeah, one? Not 11. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. There were people I knew who collected the hell out of those maps.
Yeah, great way to grind. I think that would be a great way to grind. Yeah. It would be a lot of fun. I mean, but it's like Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon. It had the Team Rainbow Rocket stuff, but for some reason, the monsters cap out at like level 70. It's like, cool, I got level 100 monsters. I mean,
one shot.
Yeah, like so many people have level 100 monsters that it's like trivial. The reason Black 2 and White 2 were perfect was because you would be playing in the Pokemon World Tournament, which was hella fun, and the monsters were matched your monster levels. So,
right.
So it was actually a fair fight as opposed to, you know, curb stomping these enemies. It's like, oh, you got a level 70 monster. That's nice. Okay, I'm going to curb stomp you now. Oh, man, that was a pretty random podcast. Let's move on to reader mail. All right, guys, last time on Axe of the Blood God, we talked about Demon's Souls. We paid tribute to it, and we had some comments to that effect. Max Beto said, I picked up a Demon's Souls about a year after it came out. It was very hard to get into. It's one of the few games where I completely restarted after having lost all my souls multiple times through 1-1 before I could even use them so that I could blast through the levels and end up with tons of souls. I remember being so scared of Phalanx and luring as many of the little ones away as I could because the rest of the level before him had been so hard. And they keep going like this, to say the least. They really liked Demon's Souls. This is actually a pretty long one. It said, I have 6 platinums for the 5 games and can thank Demon's Souls for the lessons it taught me, Umbasa. And Nice Guy Neon says, I will say this about Demon's Souls being the for sure game of the year in 2009. Every Souls game I've played has been a sure game of the year choice, even if I opted for something different. The design and gameplay just feel timeless, no matter how many times I play or which entry it is. It took a real masterpiece in later years to compete and top each Souls sequel, Bayonetta 2 in 2014, Witcher 3 in 2015, for example. However, I'm fully committed to the idea that if the Souls series were introduced in those later years for the very first time as opposed to 2009, I would have said it was the very best game of 2014 or 2015. Anthony, did you play Demon's Souls?
I played Demon's Souls, and I imported Demon's Souls because I was one of those people who owned a PlayStation 3.
Yeah,
really,
what a nerd.
Really, and was just desperate.
And you needed games.
I was like, there's an exclusive from the guys that made Otogi. Yes! And so I got it, and I that was the one. There was no documentation. Yet,
right.
there was nothing out there. There was, like, a NeoGAF thread that was as impenetrable as the game was. And I played through the first boss, which was this gelatinous mass of, like, jellyfish that were armored. And got through that after, you know, like, 6 or 7 hours. It was brutal just figuring that out. And what happens in that first castle in Demon's Souls is you finish off the first boss, a giant door opens, and there's a bridge on the other side. And you go out, I started walking across the bridge, and a screen-sized dragon just appears and sets everything on the bridge on fire. And I was like, nope, screw you, I'm done with you. Demon's Souls.
I love RPGs that step things up like that in one, like in 5 seconds. Oh man, you feel so good conquering this low level boss, and then hey, guess what's next? I'm a big fuck off dragon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nope. That's the entire Souls experience. And some people find that super energizing, and I was just like, no. No.
I get intimidated. I get scared.
The second
dragon.
I saw that dragon, I was like, whoa man, what a badass. And once you discover that you could kill the dragon, even better.
Yeah, super cool. I traded that import copy of Demon's Souls for Folklore.
Oh God!
Why would you
dig
do that?
Deep.
God.
I regret nothing. 6-axis control for life.
Oh my lord.
Yeah.
Brandon Hall says Final Fantasy XV's ending is the first to top my old favorite, Final Fantasy X. You may recall, folks, by the way, that we talked about RPG endings a couple of episodes ago. Final Fantasy XV also had a journey that I really enjoyed, that I felt informed and supported the ending beautifully. The camaraderie of the boys was very entertaining and touching. I would have liked it if the story bits about the origins of the friendships and those anime shorts were included in the game itself. The fact that they fleshed it all out only helps support the ending more. Which, by the way, the Final Fantasy XV is out on PC this week, and it looks really gorgeous.
Mm.
Yeah, my friend is playing it for the first time, so she's like, oh my god, I love Ignis so much! And of course, she's going crazy about all the food, because who wouldn't?
We posted an article earlier this week. I believe it was titled, Final Fantasy XV is Still Tearing the U.S. Gamer Staff Apart. Because it is! It is totally tearing the U.S. gamer staff apart. We all have very divisive opinions about this game. Katie and Mike are very much on the anti-side. Nani and I are very much on the pro side, and...
I'm surprised at Mike. Mike's usually very positive about everything he plays.
I don't know about that, actually. I think Katie runs extremely hot and cold. I think Mike... If Mike really doesn't like something, he will let you know about it. And he will, like, relentlessly beat the drum of why he doesn't think it's that good a game. He's very particular about that kind of stuff, so...
He calls Final Fantasy XV Slow Kingdom Hearts. He's like, why would I want to play Slow Kingdom Hearts? And I'm like, well, I can't argue with that.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I have heard Mike talk very, very badly about Star Citizen. But I suppose that's not liking a game. That's, like, not liking a myth. So it's
that's like not liking a cult.
Okay, right. can I just say something very briefly about Star Citizen before we wrap up?
Sure.
Sure.
Y'all put in $60 or $100 into a game that wasn't even concept art in, what, 2012?
2012.
And they promised the universe to you. Literally, they promised the universe. You were going to be in this giant universe with FPS elements, and it's going to be an MMO, and it's going to have a single-player campaign. Guess what, y'all? It takes time to make that game, okay? It takes time. You all wanted to put your money in there and have it out in 6 months. That's not how it works. Friggin' Fallout 4 took a decade to make. Horizon Zero Dawn was being made on and off from 2010. Okay, games take a long time to make now. You put money into a game that wasn't even concept in 2012. Don't expect it until like 2025, is what I'm saying. And you're all sitting here going, oh, this game is a total scam. It's stolen my money because it didn't give it out to me in like 6 months. If you want the game that you want, this ultimate Uber game, you're going to have to wait for it. I'm sorry. So that's my thoughts on Star Citizen.
I have absolutely zero dog in this fight because...
I put $60 into this game, by the way, so I have a horse in this fight.
Oh, you'll get it. Right. You'll get it someday, Kat, don't worry.
A very bitey horse.
Kat, all right. Kat, I wanna just say one thing about Final Fantasy XV. Arden is a better villain than Kefka. Just putting it out there. Just putting it out there for the world.
He looks like Aqualung, like an anime Aqualung. He's a weirdo. Like, what's wrong with his hair?
I love Arden. I love Arden so much.
He is. I like him, don't get me wrong, but I'm like, hey, it's like, why is Aqualung talking to me in this truck stop? And that's why I love Final Fantasy XV, all this weird shit happening in truck stops.
Arden believes that it's all about ethics in games journalism.
Oh.
Acts of Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are sold. You can follow me on Twitter at @_catbot. Nadia is @NadiaOxford, and follow us on all of the social media channels, Twitter and Facebook at US GamerNet. We're also on Twitch. We stream every Tuesday and Thursday, the US Gamer Lunch Hour. Stream at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. We've been hitting a lot of different games. I hunted Elder Dragons just the other day with Hiren, our very reclusive guides writer. He doesn't want to be reclusive, but yeah, he helped me out with Elder Dragons. Anthony, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @ajohnagnello. You can find me at my day job, venturebeat.com. You can find my writing at the AV Club. And you can hear me on my other podcast, which is the Continue podcast. And that's @ContinuePod on Twitter for new episodes.
Anthony, yes, follow John Agnello on Twitter for all of his hot Breath of the Wild takes.
Hot Breath of the Wild.
So many takes. Steaming and hot.
I will never, ever stop being angry about it.
All right. On that note, I'm going to cut you off because I don't need to hear more Breath of the Wild hot takes. But no. we'll be back next week. And until then, for Anthony, Nani, and myself, thanks for listening. Until then, happy adventuring.